is a problem with her. They don't want this thing to happen again. They want to find out if it was part of the space station. Another guy going to go out and grab the same thing, and the same thing happened, maybe go down 3, 4, 5 layers. I don't know. I haven't heard an answer on that. And they're a little concerned about, you know, why this happened. So to bring the glove back. By the way, yes, he does have spare gloves. All the spacewalkers have spare gloves on board. You know, they do 3, 4 spacewalks, 6, 7, 8 hours each, and I mean, it's tough. They say it's very hard to grab things. You abuse your gloves when you're up there. So, it was this mission back then.
Now, I know that the astronauts, I believe the International Space Station runs at something like 10.7 pounds per square inch, slightly enhanced oxygen percentage, I think. And then the astronauts, for a given number of hours, go into a lower pressure environment to make sure they boil off all of the nitrogen that's in their bloodstream so they don't get the bends. And then in the actual spacesuit, they run at an even lower pressure, and I believe it's pure oxygen. Do you happen to know the pressure that they run the spacesuit at? Is it something like 3 or 4 PSI? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, it's 5. I've read that many, many times. It's 5 PSI, pure oxygen. And this was a problem from even the earlier missions. You know, you go up in a Gemini mission, and you have to depressurize the cabin because you got your partner in there. They have 2 astronauts at a time, the Apollo mission. Same way. Now, you know, that they have that ability now to seal off different areas like that. That's really wonderful. It makes it a lot better. They eat, they sleep in there. But don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, these two guys who are ready to go out, they're in a quest to seal off from the other guys. But yet they get up in the morning, they open the door, they go into a pressurized area, they use the toilet facilities, whatever, come back, close it back up. It doesn't change that quick. And then off they go on their spacewalk. They're going to do the same thing with future moon missions. You know, you're going to have 4 guys landing at one time, 4 astronauts landing, and you're going to have a sealed off area. And you might send 2, well, they'll be sending 2 out of each time on a spacewalk run. You'll have the other 2 guys in an isolated area because you're going to have a bigger spacecraft. You're going to have that capability in the future there. So that's the way to go. Back to you.
And I'm guessing the reason that the spacesuit runs at 5 PSI, roughly one-third of normal sea level air pressure, is first of all, it's simpler to run the, let's call it the air conditioning system, the environmental control system with pure oxygen, as opposed to keeping the right ratio of oxygen and nitrogen all the time. Second of all, with the suit at lower pressure, you don't have to worry as much about the rate of leakage of the field. And second of all, the elbows and the wrists and the knees and everything else on the suit that has to bend has to be a constant volume joint, otherwise the air pressure inside will fight the bending. It's like taking a long sausage-shaped balloon and trying to bend it into another shape. That's what the spacesuit almost has to do. And so at a lower pressure, it's easier to do that. And second of all, the glove is an area where you can't make constant volume joints on all of the fingers of the glove. So if the glove was running at 5 PSI, it was running at 15 PSI, 14.7, I guess it would be very difficult to close your fingers and hand on an object. And if any leak occurred, the rate at which the leakage would occur would be at least 2 times faster. So it looks to me like there's a whole lot of history of running spacesuits at a low pressure. And I am guessing these are some of the reasons. Am I close to being on target, Paul, for the S2N? K2R.
K2KEY.
KEY recognized.
And good evening, Mel. And yeah, that's the number one is the last reason. Everything else is based around that, Dick. You're right. You'd be like a freaking balloon. You wouldn't be able to close your hand, Dick. I heard Mel. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Mel. Mel, you got the floor. I'd like to find out what the engineer of Dover Street's been doing this week and what's in the mailbag. And you probably got some comments on spacesuits. K2KEY, K2RIW.
good evening all. This is KEY. Is it true that NASA had a contest for the redesign of the glove, and I believe they awarded some prize to some company or to some individual who did a complete redesign of the glove, Dick, over?
Okay, Paul, that's for you. This one, I ain't got no spots on this one.
No, I haven't heard that. Wow. Now, I don't know, these $10 million spaces, each one for each astronaut, wow. Complete redesign of the glove. First one to redesign it was Buzz Aldrin. He was a physics guy, boy. He was when he first got up there, and it's gone through many different designs after that. But no, I haven't heard that. No, you know, that's interesting. There's been so many changes with the spaces. They've improved them so much. It's going to be interesting when they go back to the moon. How different the suits that they wear then compared to what they wore during the sixth landing back in there.
Now, I have the impression from what you just said, Paul, that each individual suit is designed for a particular torso of a particular astronaut. Heaven help him if he gains some weight before he goes on his next mission. But are the gloves individually designed? In other words, is there a glove for astronaut A which is different than the glove for astronaut B? Back to you, Paul.
Yes, definitely. And the only ones that are, see, the Russians have, you know, their spaces are different. They can get different sized people into the different suits. They call them the all-land spaces. In fact, they're put on completely different. They have them. It's not one size fits all, but, you know, one size is close enough. But the Americans are, you know, if a woman is going up, she's got her spacesuit, and if a guy's going up, he's 6 foot, he's got his. Different sizes for different people. I think the all-land spaces are kind of like, you know, small, medium, and large, you know, by the Russians. And they could get into them completely different. It's interesting if you ever watch it. The American suit, you put your bottoms on, and then the tops come over you, and you've got these O-rings all over, and they connect you that way. The Russians, they open up the back. Here's the space, you know, just sitting there. They open up the back, and they crawl it. You know, they crawl it, and they put their feet in, and they put their body in, their hands. It's completely a different setup. Americans have used them. Americans have used, you know, gone EVA on board the space station with the Russians. And they had to go through this procedure as well. And naturally, they're trained at Star City and on how to do it and all. But completely, everything's different, you know, between the Russians and the Americans. But everything's form-fitting. It's kind of like the chairs, you know, when you are going to the space station to stay on board, like the three that they left behind, as they're up there still flying around for another, who knows how many months, roughly 6 months at a time. If I'm chosen as an astronaut to go up, they need to fit me for the Russian chair, because the Russian Soyuz spacecraft is the lifeboat of the International Space Station. So what happens is, When I go up there, the first thing that leaves the International Space Station after you go in and shake hands is my chair will be brought through. Forget about the water. Forget about the food. The chair comes through and it goes all the way through the space station into the Soyuz spacecraft. They take the other chair out that fits, you know, Joe Baloney, who's going to go back, and they install my chair into the Soyuz spacecraft. And now I officially become the crew member. And when you guys leave, you can leave now. If there's an emergency, I'm staying behind, and I got my Soyuz spacecraft I can go back on. So there's the seats and gloves and spacesuits are all specifically designed with the Americans back then.
Fascinating. Does a astronaut who is using the Soyuz spacecraft, which is continuously connected to the International Space Station, as a lifeboat, when he comes back home, is he wearing an American spacesuit or a Soviet spacesuit? Back to you, Paul.
All in, they call it, yeah, the Soviet, the all in spacesuit. Yeah, that's it. Your American suit. It's in the Quest lab for EVAs that you might be doing up there. So that's it. Come back, you're with the Russians. And it's a shame they did away with the X-38 program, that we were going to have our own lifeboat attached to the spacecraft. It looked like a very small shuttle, no windows, and I was going to be brought up in cargo bay and attached to one of the ports on the nose, somewhere there's a nose there. We have a nose one up there, there's going to be a nose two brought up there shortly. And attached to it was going to be this small shuttle of crap that we put seven astronauts in, and that would have been our own. And then they would have come back with that. That set up. And by the way, they were coming back without spaces from the X-38 program, but that's pretty much it, Dick. WS time.
Thank you, Paul, for all that information. So, Mel, I think it's time we go back to you, and as I said, what is the scientist on Dover Street doing this week, and how's the mail going, and have you done any further listening with that magic loop antenna of yours on HF frequencies, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, good evening again. This is K2KEY. Why I mentioned that, I have seen, I think, a program on where NASA went back to the public for answers to certain questions. And one of the questions was about the flexibility and the use of the glove that is on the space suit. And they had a prize, a contract with some one that could submit a better designed glove. I remember seeing that program. I think it was on CBS or something. I don't remember where, but it was very interesting that they, like I said, it would go back to the public for answers to certain problems that they come up with. Let's see. First one I got here. First, does anybody else want to make a comment before we start looking into how many? I'm just laughing because you mentioned spam. I got a lot of spam here, but related to radio spam. Take over.
I know what you're saying. Most of the spam I get are people trying to sell me magic pills that are going to do all kinds of fancy things. I think you know what I mean. One or two of the spams I get are good things. One or two of them are advertisements for some good scientific books and things like that. So I have to go down my spam file and scrutinize it a little bit before I discard it. But my spam is continuously increasing, and I had somebody who's pretty knowledgeable about the Internet telling me that something like 80% of all the traffic on the Internet today is spam, and it's growing. Thank goodness the system can handle it without bogging down. Boy, that's an awful lot of unsolicited information. And I've signed up for all these lists that supposedly keep you off the spam list. I don't think it works. Back to you, Mel.
I'm Roger. Okay, well, I have, you know, separate listing with for amateur radio. So that sort of helps a little bit separate the two. As far as the loop goes, I haven't done much with it on 75 East. As of late 18, it's been really a madhouse. We've had, I think, a lot of thunderstorm activity this year. And it's, the noise level is at times phenomenal on 75 East. It's just one crash after another. So we've done some HF work with my friends actually on 40 meters, a little less, a little bit more, you know, tolerable, but totally winter really, you know, settles down. 75 meters is a rough band on during the summer months. Okay, what else? of trying to find something here.
Oh.
Yeah, we got a thank you. The last commentary you fellows made about MUF last week was extremely helpful. I finally got to understand what MUF really means. It was a great way that you gave the explanation. Thank you to the net. Okay. Compliments. I'm looking up to see what else we got here. Trying to find something that, you know, put out on the air a bit. Let's see. Oh, okay. Here's a question. Hey, about cable. All right? Read it over quickly. Let's see. I am worried. Okay. What happens if I'm running full legal power and my SWR all of a sudden goes way up? Like, who knows? It's off to 10 to 1 for all I know. What happens, what will happen to my RG8 cable? Oh boy. They, well, nothing to be added to this. What will happen to you? Nothing really, but give a, you want to give a more of an explanation why you take over?
Yes, I do. There's two universal laws that I've got, two very simple equations, almost as simple as some of Mel's equations, of what happens when you misconnect a piece of coax. It's based on the assumption you've got a real transmitter that happens to be a 50-ohm, 7-impedance source. Our transmitters happen not to be that, but let's assume that it is. If I had a real signal generator, for instance, that's a 50-ohm output impedance going into a piece of RG8U coax, and if I connect it to a 50-ohm dummy load, if you tell me the power that's going through the cable, I can tell you exactly what voltage is on the cable. So far, so good. The next question would be, what happens if the cable at the dummy load end suddenly becomes a perfect open circuit? The answer is, the voltage that used to be there doubles. That's all. You open circuit a piece of transmission line that has a 50-ohm generator into a 50-ohm cable, regardless of the length of the cable, open circuit, you would think the voltage goes to infinity. It simply doubles. Conversely, if instead of the perfect dummy load at the end, I put a perfect short circuit at the end, what happens? The current someplace in the cable doubles. In the case of open circuiting the cable, the voltage doubles right at the end of the cable and every halfway from that. In the case of putting a perfect short circuit at the end of the cable, the current at the end of the cable doubles at that location. Go a quarter wave downrange. So the current is half, but the voltage is doubled. Go another quarter wave down lane, and you're toward the transmitter, and you're back to the same condition again. Double current, zero voltage, essentially. And so from that point of view, you can see that tremendous mismatch of a cable with just a doubling of the voltage, and the cable's got a lot of spare voltage capability, or doubling the current, the cable has a lot of spare current capability. That in itself will not damage your valuable piece of cable, no matter what it is, with rare exception. If you're using a piece of cable where the absolute max is 101 watts, and you're running 100 watts into it, and you suddenly put a short or an open, yeah, you're going to get yourself in trouble. That's not the cable you're using. The only other thing you've got to worry about is what is making the standing wave ratio suddenly jump. I once had a 6-meter homebrew Yagi, 6-element Yagi, which I made out of, I think it was half-inch diameter conduit tubing for all the elements. But the elements were pure aluminum. And it was a gamma match assembly that fed the driven element. And I had homebrewed this whole thing. And in order to connect to the element halfway between the boom and the tip of the element, the driven element, I had wrapped a copper strap around the element and brought that into the gamma rod. Well, I eventually discovered something called dissimilar metals. On an outdoor experiment, on an outdoor environment, you never bring copper in direct contact with aluminum. Those two dissimilar metals make up a battery. Eventually, some green goo and slime grew in between the copper and the aluminum, and it made a very scratchy contact. So I could start off listening on 6 meters, and the signal sounded a little bit too weak. I would start transmitting into the antenna, and the VISWR would be very high, and all of a sudden it would jump down as I was arcing through that corrosion that existed between the copper strap and the aluminum rod. The similar metals were making a very flaky contact, even though I had a 3/4 inch wide piece of copper strap wrapped around this half inch diameter aluminum conduit tubing. I mean, by all appearance, I had a great big wide contact. Well, it was making a very flaky contact because of the corrosion that was growing in there. My solution was to look at the dissimilar metal table and realize that copper and solder are similar, solder and aluminum are similar, but copper and aluminum are dissimilar, not allowed to be together. I simply tinned the copper. I cleaned everything up with steel wool. I should have been using Scotch Brite, but I cleaned it all up with steel wool. I then tinned the copper with solder and reconnected it and had no further trouble for the rest of the life of the system. So in my case, I was getting a flaky contact that would change contact resistance as a function of putting power through it. There is the possibility also of having a connector that for some reason is making poor contact. Water got into it, corrosion occurred, where male and female comes together and whatever. And you pour a kilowatt through a poor connector, you can generate an awful lot of local heat. Very similar to what happens with what some of the guys were discussing earlier, where you have poor connectors on household wiring. A very small amount of voltage drop at high current can represent quite a few watts, creates quite a bit of heat, and potentially can burn down a house. Well, in the case of a poor contact at a connector and a kilowatt of power, you could generate quite a bit of local heat and do a little bit of local damage right at the connector. The chances of it burning up your cable, except for the last inch, is almost nothing. The chances of it destroying the rest of your antenna, very, very slim. The worst that I can think of is it may really char the inside of your connector and possibly make it useless. Other than that, I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over that. However, the fact that your standing wave ratio does change when you transmit, or the fact that it does change day to day, being a good scientist, and inside of each ham radio operator is a scientist trying to get out, I think, it behooves you to try to find out what's going on. It shouldn't be that way. There is some kind of a contact that's improper because of not being properly weatherproof, not being properly screwed together, cross-threaded, whatever. You should investigate what is causing it, and by divide and conquer, step by step, you open up each connector and look at it, and you give a visual inspection to everything in the whole system, make sure the wire of the antenna is not coming over and rubbing against the aluminum gutter or the downspout. Make sure the wiring was never anywhere near 110-volt wiring or LiPo wiring or Con Ed wiring. Never put any part of your antenna within 10 feet of that if you could possibly avoid it. You wouldn't believe how much danger there is with any of your ham radio antennas coming in contact with power wiring of Con Ed, Loco, New Jersey Power and Light, whatever. Just make sure that could never happen in any worst-case situation. So a change in VISWR is something that certainly should be investigated, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, first of all, I believe I saw the publicity cable RTAQ as a cable that was rated at voltage of 4,000 volts. Do you remember seeing that thing over?
At least. I know of people who have put 10,000 volts through RGA cable, and as long as they properly prepare the end with the right kind of connectors, it works like a charm. The voltage rating of that cable is huge. The current rating of that cable is way beyond requirements, so for you to have a high standing wave ratio and burn up that cable with a kilowatt, I think it would be very difficult. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, so at 50 ohms, we could honestly put about, I guess, 80 amperes through it, and if it's pushing it to the end. I guess we did push 80 amperes through the current, I guess, which just melts the center conductor, am I correct?
Yeah, but 80 amperes represents a huge amount of wattage. I'm about to do a quick calculation on this. The peak voltage of a kilowatt is somewhere around 300 volts, and the cable can take 4,000 volts by rating, and probably 10,000 volts in reality. And we can also calculate the current of a kilowatt on 50 ohms. That's the I squared R. I squared has to be 20. But square root of 20 is what the current of a kilowatt is. 4 and a fraction amperes. And I think, like you said, I'll bet you that cable can take an easy 40 amperes, and a kilowatt normally is only 4 and a fraction amperes. As I see it, a cable is safe as all hell, no matter how you're abusing it, if you're only putting a kilowatt through it. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, if we put 80 amperes or somewhere up to 70, 80 amperes through it, we're talking about a possibility like 300 what, kilowatt power. So I think your 1 kilowatt, yeah, I think that if your SWR is jumping up that high, or for any reason going up that high, I would say you're going to have more of a problem with the amplifier than you're going to have with the cable. And I assume the amplifier may go into shutdown or have a slight mild breakdown and something in there, or maybe a major breakdown if you continuously, you know, run that kind of situation at a kilowatt level. But as far as cable is concerned, I don't think you're going to see anything happen. Of course, we're talking about, you're talking about HF frequencies and all what happens at different frequencies. As the, of course, you go up in frequency, it in effect increase the AC resistance and also, but still you have nothing really, I believe, to worry about. Hot spots in the cable, things of that sort. On good quality cable, at a kilowatt, I think you're pretty safe. I would assume, Dick, over.
I highly agree. A kilowatt through RG58 with a short circuit or an open circuit or high vis, I think you could get yourself in trouble. But from 30 megacycles down, a kilowatt on RG8, real RG8 cable with polyethylene, RG213, RG214, it'll just laugh at that situation and keep right on cranking. So, not to worry. Got another one, Mel?
This is K2KEY. I'm looking through. I'm going to say there's a lot of stuff here that can't do nothing about, but cannot put it out on the air. Or can I help you? It seems like they persist and repeating over and over certain questions that either we covered lots of detail or that I don't think we can comment on legally or whatever. Better look over. All right, here's something. Okay, Mel, you're always talking about your four-way loop. Aha, okay. Here we are with four-way loops again. What do I do? I'd like to use a full-wave loop. I hear there's a lot of good reasons for using a loop. If you claim that the noise is a man-made noise and it works better than a common dipole, and further on, and you don't require a ground screen and radios and things like that. However, how can I compress the full wave loop? I'd like to get on 80 meters like you, but I have no room to put up a full wave loop. How can I foreshorten this? Well, I've had this discussion. I've did some modeling with this. What do you recommend? Well, number of things. You want to make comments, Dick? First, what you think, and tell you what I found. Over.
Okay. For those who are really serious about such frequencies, a full-wave loop up in the air is a substantial-looking antenna. It requires a significant amount of enthusiasm and resources to establish it. The performance is quite good. The people do it, get on the air, brag about it. They're happy. They've made the investment in man-hours and dollars and equipment, and they get an antenna that they're pretty happy with. What Mel is discovering with his very small loops that are inside the house, which has a certain relationship with the isotron antenna. You look up isotron, and you find out that they can put a 160, an 80, a 40, or a 20-meter antenna in the shack with you. And when properly tuned, it gives performance very similar to any other antenna you could have put at that particular altitude. Now, if you want to maybe go hog wild and you want a compact antenna, but you want full performance, maybe you take an isotron and mount it at a higher altitude. But Mel is finding out, though, is that his receiving antenna, the fact that his small loop, which is something he can squeeze into the shack with him, he can refer you to the right article, and also it's in the antenna in the ARL antenna book. You can see what the actual loop looks like. It doesn't require a lot of resources. But because it is adaptable in azimuth steering, elevation steering, and polarization steering, because it has that adaptability, he can get a stronger signal on reception than you're going to get with any other reasonable antenna, even at higher altitudes. That's a hard one to accept as a receiving antenna. Now, everything I know about antenna reciprocity, which means whatever performance you get on an antenna on reception, pattern, gain, efficiency, front-to-back ratio, whatever performance you get when the antenna is being used for receiving, the laws of antenna science say that you have to get the exact same performance on transmitting. For a bunch of reasons of being conservative on radio frequency biohazard, to this date, to my knowledge, Mel has not done any substantial amount of transmitting back through that antenna. And he is going to discover, in my opinion, when he transmits back through that antenna, that he's going to have to reorient it differently, because Faraday rotation off the ionosphere does not obey reciprocity. The antenna obeys reciprocity. How it performs on reception and how it performs on transmission must be the same with any reasonable passive antenna, an antenna that doesn't contain an amplifier. But the ionosphere doesn't have to obey that law. So I think when Mel finally runs the experiment of transmitting into his loop, he's going to have to find a brand new way of positioning it so that his buddy in Pennsylvania gets maximum signal. So he'll have a transmitting position and a receiving position. And for a guy with his resources, I mean, these guys on Dover Street, they got money pouring out of their pockets. They don't know what to do with it all. So he someday is going to have a transmitting loop and a receiving loop. He'll carefully position the receiving loop so his buddy gets a stronger signal into his shack, into Mel's shack, and then he'll carefully position the transmitting loop a few feet away so that his buddy in Pennsylvania gets the stronger signal. And then with his TR relay, he'll flip back and forth between those two antennas. You wait and see. Mel's going to do that one of these days. And maybe even someday he'll find a way of electronically combining those two. So within the same structure, he can do that. So right now, Mel hasn't done a lot of transmitting, I think. But as soon as he studies the problem and realizes that as long as the antenna is more than, I'm going to pick a number, 8 feet or 10 feet away from him at one end of the shack, Mel's shack is 22 feet long. He's got a nice big room dedicated in that house for his radio experiment. So he's going to put the loop antenna at one end. His transmitting location is at the other end. He's far enough away to be super safe. And then he's going to find out that transmitting through that loop is going to work like a charm. That's my prediction. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's very wishful thinking about the size of a shack that's in K2KEY. Now, this person here is interested in a full wave outside loop, not the one, the loop that I'm using, the loop I've been using in the shack. Yes, I did do some transmitting through it at low power. And no, I'm not particularly interested in that's why actually I did the transmitting through it under better conditions right now. Not the ideal conditions to do any of that kind of experiment. I would attempt putting a kilowatt into it next to me, you know, within a few feet of me. My shack is nowhere near 22 feet long. I can say wishful thinking. What this person is interested in is my outside loop, which is 272 feet square. And he'd like to go on 160 meters and like to know if he can take this loop, this outside loop, 272 feet, and even reduce it down so I can use it on 160 and 80 meters and make it smaller. How would you go about it? this outside, like I say, I have four supports for it. He says I'm on a, I'm reading on here. He says I'm on he says a moderate sized city lot. And he gives me dimensions. And he'd like to make it half the size of what I have. And he's it on 160 and 80. And I have looked into this somewhat, Dick, again, the modeling program. And there's been a few people, I believe, that have gone ahead and built this antenna and actually put it into the vertical position. And I'll tell you why, what they basically had in mind. And I have discussed it, and a couple of guys, of course, like I say, right now, the way conditions are in those bands, I haven't been keeping up with what's going on, but I have suggested a couple of ways of doing it, and I believe one person has gone ahead, and I guess I won't get back to really definite what definitive answers to the, how well it works, but I basically want to take the time to discuss a little bit what we went ahead and suggested over.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat, I didn't make it super clear, but to build a full wave loop and mount it, let's say, 40 feet in the air outside, it's a good-looking antenna, substantial piece of hardware, significant investment, and normally when a person puts that much dedication into a project, he starts off with a mental bias where he knows it's going to work well, and when he goes on the air, he collects all the information of how well it works, and he tells everybody how well it works. And if in certain areas it doesn't work well, he happens not to mention that. That's human nature. So when you put that all together, a person listening to those conversations will say, boy, a full wave loop, 40 feet in the air, that's the best antenna in the world, I'm going to go for it. I'm not convinced that's true. Except for a little bit of difference in performance due to altitude, I am convinced that Mel's steerable small loop in the shack is giving the best, the same performance or a better performance. That's what I'm believing. So I'm saying to the person who wants to build the full wave loop, go slow on that. But now when it comes to taking any antenna that is less than multiple wavelengths long and making it smaller physically and then compensating for that by any one of three or four techniques. You can take any antenna in the world, and everyone believes an antenna is only antenna if it resonates. They believe that. Absolutely, positively, not true. The word resonance is definitely required in the antenna radiating system. The antenna itself doesn't have to radiate. It doesn't have to resonate. By way of the impedance matching device between your transmission line and that antenna, the impedance matching device that you put there, which may be called an antenna tuner, may be called an impedance matching transformer, may be made out of ferrite, maybe it's made out of coax because it's a quarter wave matching transformer, whatever kind of device you put there can force the antenna to be properly impedance matched to your feed line, at least at one frequency, if not a whole host of frequencies, and to resonate. And if your feed line is low enough and lost, you're not violating any of the laws of physics, and you're not going to sacrifice a great deal of efficiency if you do that resonating in the shack. The antenna tuner can be in the shack right alongside of your transmitter. The feed line could be any high-quality feed line going out to your very non-resonant antenna that's much too small in size. If you do that correctly, the whole system can be forced into electronic resonance of the radiating system and behave like a charm. You go to the right book, start off with the ARL antenna book, then proceed to chapter 4 of the antenna engineering handbook. For any reasonable antenna you're likely to build, whether it be loop, monopole, dipole, or whatever, there is documented evidence that as you squeeze it down in size, you can predict ahead of time exactly how many ohms of resistive component of impedance it will have. You can predict exactly how many ohms of reactive impedance it will have. It's all predetermined for you. And if you're smart enough, you can design the impedance matching network. Bell has, in one case, chosen a pretty yucky antenna. He chose an example with using the Smith chart, showing you where to mount the stub, how long to make the stub, so that you bring that whole yucky antenna back into good 50-ohm resonance at your favorite frequency. There's a zillion ways you can do it. Short as an open stub, one or two of them, a piece of matching networks, an antenna tuner, any of these things placed in the right location. In some cases, in the case of an antenna tuner, you can put it almost anywhere you want because it's so variable. You can force that system with the antenna that's too small to have exactly the impedance you want and exactly the efficiency you want. The only thing that happens that you might not like is that an antenna, I don't care if it's a dipole, loop, or whatever, if you don't have the ability to steer it mechanically or steer it electronically, most simple antennas have a null in some direction. If I set my dipole north-south, it'll radiate beautifully broadside east and west, and it will have a null in its performance north and south. If I make it an inverted V, even that null disappears. So, pattern-wise, with an antenna that can't be steered electronically and mechanically, there may be certain areas of the compass that you don't cover very well. But other than that, you choose the size physical of antenna you want because of the property you want. I will admit that as you make the antenna smaller and smaller, the amount of heroicness required to re-impedance match it and re-resonate it gets more difficult. It's doable, but it gets more difficult. So if you've only got enough property to build an antenna of one-third the size of somebody's design, and if it's a simple dipole or loop-like antenna, and you build it one-third the size, the good books will tell you what impedance you're going to get. The good articles on impedance matching and the good discussion on impedance matching will tell you how to do the impedance matching, and you can make the whole system have 98% radiation efficiency, even though it's one-third the size. That is a deterministic problem. Lots of smart people have been there before you have, and it's doable. Don't let anybody talk you out of it. 90% of the hams on 20 meters or 40 meters are going to say, no, it can't possibly work. If you don't resonate it, it won't work. To a degree, they're right, but the it that you're resonating doesn't have to be the antenna itself. You only have to resonate the radiating system, consisting of antenna, feed line, and antenna tuner. So don't give up. Build it to small size, and now you can start bragging about the fact you're getting full performance, but you didn't have to spend all that money making it full size. That's a whole series of opinions. Been there, done that. I'm in the business occupationally, day after day, squeezing antennas into very small packages because somebody ain't got the right amount of room. I'm the guy who does that as an occupation. And I've got a few patents on how to do that. I didn't say it's easy, but don't give up. It's doable. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment, please, N2RSO.
Formation. And to RSO first, and then Howie after that. RSO, go ahead. Start up with your name, sir.
Yes, good evening, Dick. My name is Frank. And getting back to the original concept of a full wave loop at 272-foot length of wire, this is kind of a simplistic answer. Wouldn't it be feasible to just take the four poles or masts, move them inward, and take that same length of wire, the 272 feet, and loop it around twice, thereby creating two loops, 138 and a half feet each, that are continuously connected, and then attaching a feed line to the termination point. My guess is that you would lose a little bit, but not that much. Dick, back to you.
Got good news for you, Frank. You would lose nothing. You'd lose nothing. You'd get almost the exact same performance by your half, I'm going to call it the half diameter loop. Now, what's the advantage of the half diameter loop, in other words, wrapped around twice, full length of wire wrapped around twice versus half the amount of wire? The only difference is the impedance you're going to see. The radiation characteristics are going to be almost the same.
I will admit that the double loop wire is going to have a much higher impedance. But in either case, if you're smart enough in knowing how to do impedance matching, or if you've got an antenna tuner with enough range, both of those antennas are going to give you 98% radiation efficiency. Is there an additional advantage of the double loop over the single loop? It's very similar to what happens when a guy wants to build a loop-like antenna for receiving these long-wave communications at 100 kilohertz, or in some cases 18 kilohertz if you're listening to a station over there in the Scandinavian area. You build multiple turns of the loop in order to make the resonance easier to raise the Q. If you happen to have only a 18-gauge wire that you're wrapping it with, and if you made only one turn, the current through that one turn would give you a lot of, the impedance would be something like 1 ohm, and you'd have 1 ohm of resistance of the wire, and therefore you'd have 50% efficiency, so to speak. Half the power would go into the resistance, the other half would go into the radiation resistance. By taking that same piece of 18-gauge wire and wrapping it multiple times, so that now that its radiation impedance is 1,000 ohms, and its resistance is only 10 ohms, so to speak, you come out way ahead. So you get a higher impedance with multiple turns, and therefore the resistivity of the wire and the gauge of the wire becomes less critical. But when a guy is putting up 270 feet or 135 feet of wire, for mechanical reasons, he has to use something like 14-gauge or 12-gauge in order for it to hang together. So the resistance of the wire and the skin effects are not the major factor here. So you've got two choices. It would be a darn interesting experiment, Frank, and 2 hours. So it would be a darn interesting experiment to build the antenna in such a way that the two turns are there, and you've got relays there, so you can flip into radiating into one turn and go to that impedance matching network, or flip the relays and go into the two turns and radiate into that impedance matching network and find out what the performance is. That would be a darn fun experiment. N2RSO, you probably have some more comments on that one. K2RIW, you got it, Frank.
No, actually, Dick, I think you covered it all. Matter of fact, I don't know the size of the lot that the original person has, the one who posed the question, but if it's fairly decent-sized lot, there's no reason why he can't make those lots, those loops, or continuous loops with that same 250 multiple loops could possibly work for him on the lot that he has to work with. So that's about all I have. Back to you, Dick. Have a great time.
Okay, Frank, glad you signed in. Interesting concept you brought to our attention. Howie, WB2HWW, what would you like to add to this one?
I'm just going to add that I was just looking at my QST and QST audio tapes. Actually, QST has an article using loop antennas for field day using balloons. This guy is like the head engineer at Qualcomm, and he's discussing how you launch it, and he also explains that it doesn't matter what the shape of the antenna is, and he said the radiating pattern will not be that much affected, and he goes into all of the technical and legal requirements with FAA and whatever else to launch a loop antenna using balloons. Go ahead, Dick. It's in March. It's in July 2007 QST.
I remember seeing that article. Beautiful article. With some nice concepts of how to hook up wire antennas at a nice high altitude as long as you're willing to launch balloons. Well done. And by the way, when you build a loop antenna, whether the loop has the plane vertical to the earth, you know, perpendicular to the earth or parallel to the earth, is one of your choices. But in either case, the average amateur believes there's going to be a significant difference in the radiated pattern if the loop is set up first as a pure circle, or second as a square, or third as a triangle, or fourth as a hexagon. It turns out because you only got one wavelength of wire and probably one-third of a wavelength of diameter, so to speak, the difference in directivity of that antenna, depending on shape,
is extremely minor perturbation. By way of the modeling programs, you can study that, and it would be an awful lot of fun to go to the right modeling program and find out what happens when the antenna is square, triangle, hexagon, circle, whatever. Very minor difference. And so once you accept the fact that the shape of the loop itself is a second-order effect, once you accept the fact that your property is either rectangular or pizza pie shaped, go ahead and mount the loop antenna in there anyhow. It'll fly. It is very difficult for you to use the right materials with a good impedance matching network to set up some kind of a wire antenna with a reasonable feed line and antenna tuner. You almost can't stop it from working well if you use a little bit of common sense. When you look in the books and you see a recommended dipole antenna, it's a completely flat-out piece of wire with a piece of transmission line coming off at exactly right angle. There's a hell of a lot of people who think that's the only thing that will work. You can take that wire and zigzag it any way you want to in three-dimensional space. You can curve it around into circles that don't close. You can curve it around into circles that do close. You can curve it around into circles that wrap multiple times. And the circle can be a triangle, a square, a hexagon, or whatever. The total number of variables you've got is huge. The difference between all those variables is rather minor. You're just trying to make a network, a radiating system that consists of transmitter, impedance matching network somewhere, if required, transmission line, and the thing that you call antenna. That radiating system, if the total system hits resonance, and if the total system has a reasonable impedance match to your transmitter, it will fly every time. You can't stop it from doing that, unless you mount it below grade or in salt water. And even then, you can't stop it. You just slow it down a little bit. We talk to our submarines at very low frequencies with antennas that are way below the surface of the seawater. You can't stop it from happening once you understand the physics of how to launch an impedance-matched resonating wave into the radiating system. You've got a huge amount of variables here that will work for you once you understand the principles involved. You can't stop it from working. Instead of thinking almost nothing will work, you should think more correctly. Almost everything must work. Very few things will not work if you use a little bit of common sense. Talk to a couple of people like Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Let me make another comment here.
Go ahead, Howie.
Prince.
Go ahead, Howie.
I remember I was 13 years old, just got my license. I had an Eichel 720 and a Halifax S85 receiver. I remember coming out of the, I remember making a dipole. I didn't know any better, but it worked. I had the dipole sneaked around the entire apartment, had the radio in the living room. He lived in a two-bedroom, five-and-a-half-room apartment, and I had it going from one room to the other room. I had the two ends of the wire come to a piece of cable that was only a couple feet long into the transmitter. Somehow I got the Eichel 720 to resonate, and I made contact on 40 meters and 80 meters at the novice. And that antenna did not look like a dipole. It was, I bent it around the apartment to get to halfway. Didn't know any better, but it worked. I don't know how well it worked, but I was able to work guys in Pennsylvania on CW back in the 60s.
I bet it really was working quite well, Howie. Further evidence that as long as you obey a couple of basic rules of impedance matching and resonating to keep the transmitter happy, and so that there's no resistive loss anywhere in the system, you can't stop it from working. The worst thing you can do that I can think of all the possible errors you can make, is the one that's very subtle. And it looks good, but works terribly bad, is to take one of these whiz-bang, fancy-looking, quarter-wave, ground-plane, vertical polarized antennas, mount it in your backyard right at ground level, and only put one or two radials down in the ground. You may end up with a beautiful standing wave ratio with that antenna, with a good antenna tuner. And because all the signal is flowing out the cable in one direction and none of it's coming back to the transmitter, you naively assume that it's all going into space. In that particular case, you've got a huge amount of resistive loss that is not obvious. There's a wave coming out of that antenna. Half of that wave is below grade, heating up that soil. That soil is a volumetric resistor. In the wintertime, you radiate a kilowatt into that, you're going to warm up that soil. You have an accurate enough thermometer, you could put a thermometer in that soil 6 inches below grade and measure an increase in temperature when you put the key down. And you're going to be warming up the worms in the wintertime, they're going to be happy you're doing it. That's the one very subtle case I can think of where a beautiful looking antenna, by all the instrumentation you have in the shack, looks like it's flying like a chop. In reality, half of all that power, and maybe more, is heating up the soil, and once you take RF energy and turn it into heat, it's gone forever. That's the only way you can destroy RF energy, is you can heat it up, turn it into a resistive thermal converter, and turn it into watts of heat. Other than that, it's going to radiate somewhere. So that's one example of where a good-looking antenna works bad. Other than that, you have a reasonable altitude, reasonable antenna, resonated, the radiating system. It's not that you think there's 50 ways it can't work. There's 50 ways that it will work. There's very few ways that it will not work. And the ways that will not work, if you're smart enough, you can find them out pretty fast. That's a series of opinions. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Thanks, this is K2KEY. A few words about it. As far as the loops go, there's been some experiments that were done. In fact, one did do that experiment, which you just mentioned about making it winding it, taking it instead of putting 272 feet and using that much property, cutting it back, making it so that the wound two turns. The result was that he found that for some reason it became more of a cloud warmer, and made a number of tests with the stations that he had previously talked to many times. They were the loopers. There's been a whole group that are very dedicated to loop antennas that are on 75 and 160 meters. And that's about all. They discussed a lot of ideas about loops. And that was the whole idea. See what happens if I went ahead and I actually, I could say, cut the area down in half and just double it up. And the consensus was that they found that it was more of a cloud warmer. And even though he did work at the same station, they all claimed that there was that his signal was nowhere as strong as when he had the full size loop. So that's the basically what the experiment was. However, I did some modeling on taking the loop and making it, instead of 60 feet on a square, 30 feet on a square, and adding inductance on two sides, using four coils, but using them two on one side and two on the side opposite them, Dick. And one guy has, more or less used the outline. He was very interested in putting up the loop. And I laid out the coils for him, tried to keep him high Q, and we'll basically, I think, get the results this winter. He's in the midst of putting this together. Instead of being 60 feet on his side, it's 30 feet on his side, Dick, but rather than doubling it up, using inductive on two opposite, in other words, where the feed line, the feed point is in the middle of one side of the 30 feet, and that's 15 feet from either side. And two inductors on that, one on each side, and then the opposite 30 feet, completely opposite of it, two more inductors of the same size. Repeater,
time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
You only lost the last few seconds of your transmission, Mel. Beyond 11 o'clock, we're into the, I think it's a two-minute timer on this particular repeater. And the way the repeater flips back from the net mode up to 11 o'clock to the normal mode requiring a 136.5
4ZTL, and we have to interrupt every 2 minutes to reset the timer. I will admit that when you wrap the loop multiple times,